You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I think we'll get going. I want to welcome everyone here today. I'm E.J. Dionne, a senior fellow here at Brookings and a colleague of Bob's. We are here to celebrate a great author, a great book, and an extraordinary piece of legislation. And this may be one of the most unusual events in Washington today, because there are two things people always talk about. One is the decline of legislating, and this book is actually about a successful attempt to legislate a very important and very complicated piece of legislation. And the other thing we hear a lot about is the decline of journalism, that journalists don't spend enough time on substance, they don't put the time in to really explore a story. Well, this book does all of those things. I want to note that the book is on sale outside, but one of the most important things at a book event is to sell the author's book, especially if you like the author, and I happen to like Bob a lot.
And it makes a perfect holiday gift.
Yes, whatever holiday, yes. Give it to someone for the 4th of July. We're celebrating the fact that Congress actually acted on this very important issue, and the book tells the story in wonderful detail, not boring detail, but wonderful detail. And for those of you who ever worked as a staffer on Capitol Hill, you will love this book because the heroes are not only two distinguished legislators called Dodd and Frank, but there are some real heroes here among staff people. And before I introduce our audience, I want to introduce guests of Senator Dodd. And the fact that they are listed that way shows how much he appreciates good staff. We have Ed Silverman, who is staff director of the Senate Banking Committee. Ed, wave to everybody. Lori McGrogan, where are you? See, you're like movie stars to me since I read the book, and now I know, you know, how important you are, who is senior advisor to Senator Dodd at the MPAA. And Brian DeAngelis, we have a whole bunch of people. Brian DeAngelis, Dylan, how do we pronounce it, Senator?
Alois.
Alois.
Amy Friend's son.
Oh, Dylan, where are you? Welcome. How are you? Amy Friend and Jean Roslanowick. Ross, thank you, Bob.
Hey, Jean.
It's great to have you all here. And when you read this book, you'll realize just how important these people are.
Particularly the last two.
What?
Particularly the last two.
Yes, exactly. Let me just introduce our panel, and I'll tell you how we're going to proceed today. I'm going to introduce Bob first, and he will sort of give you a sense of how he came to write this book and tell you a bit of the story, followed by Senator Dodd, and I really appreciate so much your joining us here today. I also appreciate the fact that Senator Dodd and Barney Frank gave Bob Kaiser full access to him all during the fight over the Dodd-Frank bill, even before it was known as Dodd-Frank. You can even tell the story of how that actually happened, which is nicely told in the book. Then Senator Dodd will comment, followed by my distinguished colleague, another of my favorite people, Tom Mann, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Bob is associate editor and senior correspondent at the Washington Post. He's worked there since 1963. He started right after the day of his birth, I think. He served as a special correspondent in London, a reporter on the City Desk, a foreign correspondent in Saigon and in Moscow. He is the author of 7 books, including The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril, So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government, and most recently, Act of Congress. Not on this list is the book you wrote about Vegas, which
Great American Dreams.
Yeah, so anybody who cares about
Long out of print.
may we bring it back into print. He is a graduate of Yale College. He received his master's from the London School of Economics. Senator Chris Dodd is the chairman and chief executive officer of the Motion Picture Association of America. That will not only guarantee that Bob's book is made into a movie, but guarantee that Senator Dodd is played by somebody really, really cool. I hope so, anyway.
Bradley Cooper, I think.
We could have nominations
Jack Nicholson
for this. That would be good. No, he's the banking lobbyist. Senator Dodd served in the United States Congress representing Connecticut for 36 years, 6 years in the House, and 30 years in the United States Senate. He has authored or co-authored legislation in the areas of education, health, financial services, foreign policy, and election reform. He played a decisive role in writing the health care reform bill, and he was co-author of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street and Consumer Protection Act, which is what we're talking about today. Tom Mann is the W. Averill Harriman Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings. He was Director of Governance Studies between 1987 and 1999. Before that, he was Executive Director of the American Political Science Association. He is the perfect commentator today because his most recent book with Norm Ornstein is called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. And I can't wait for Tom to bring that to bear on this. He and Norm were recently named among the 100 top global thinkers of 2012. He earned his BA from the University of Florida and his PhD at the University of Michigan. I am utterly biased as a moderator. Bob Kaiser, along with David Natius, probably two most important people, reasons why I work for the Washington Post. Tom Mann is someone, I come from Massachusetts where politics isn't always on the level, and Tom is on a special list I have, which is people I would commit felonies for. Fortunately, Tom has never asked me to commit one. No one on that list has ever asked me to commit one. And one of the themes of Bob Kaiser's book is that Senator Dodd was one of the most popular people in Congress. People like Senator Dodd a lot. And I've always been, I suppose I shouldn't confess this as a journalist, but I've always been one of those people. And so it's great to have you all here. Bob, welcome, and thank you for coming.
Well, thank you. I don't know why you're giving Ignatius any credit. I was responsible entirely.
Well, he had the power.
And very proud. There's a photo circulating on the internet. Maybe some of you have seen it. It's of a handmade sign, the kind of sign that cheap motels use to advertise free HBO. But this one has a more pointed message. It says, "Can't we just throw Congress off the fiscal cliff?" I found this by chance one day. I thought somebody out there deserved a prize for capturing the spirit of the times. Excuse me. As you know, the approval rating of Congress now ranges around 10-15%. I've been thinking about this. Who are the approvers? What is it that they're approving?
They're all in this room, former staffers scattered around the nation.
It's too easy to joke about it, but it really matters. As I say in the subtitle of this book, Congress really is our essential institution. When it's broken, the country is not well governed, and that's serious. This book, this project, began with a phone call from Barney Frank. And I had to confess this to Dodd back in 2009. A little nervously. I met Barney just the other day in 1961. We were both student politicians. We were at the National Student Congress. Chris, I calculate, was then 17. He was about to start his senior year at Georgetown Prep, I believe. Anyway, Barney and I stayed friendly from that time on. I watched his extraordinary career. Interestingly, I was 18, he was 21. We both knew exactly what we wanted to do, and we were both lucky enough to do it. That was a bigger deal in Barney's case because although he didn't talk about it to anybody at the time, he already knew he was gay, and he already knew that was going to be an impediment to his political ambitions. Luckily, he got around that ultimately. When he made that phone call, he was being a good pal. He said, "Your next book ought to be about this stuff." I said, "Well, what stuff?" He said, "Well, the crash. All that's going on, it's a huge story." Barney, of course, was in the middle of it because he had, after patient waiting, just ascended 2 years earlier to the chairmanship of the House Financial Services Committee, as Dodd had just ascended at exactly the same moment to the chairmanship of Senate Banking. Dodd's wait was even longer, a story that he loves to tell and may inflict on you later this afternoon. But he really had bad luck. He sat in the Senate for 28 years before becoming a chairman of anything. That might be a world record. the man he succeeded on banking was called Paul Sarbanes. You all remember him. I love Dodd's description of Sarbanes, somebody whose heart beat once an hour. Which,
and a great friend, I mean.
And a good guy, a Rhodes Scholar. But,
a good way to live a very long time.
Exactly, that's the point. I mean, he did. He retired in good health. He's still in good health. So I asked Barney, what's the book? When you say I should write a book, what's the book? Oh, he said, that's your department. So I thought about it. And I thought about the fact that both he and Dodd had already made it clear that they wanted to pass some big piece of legislation in response to the great crash. And I realized that the world had really never had a good book in the modern era describing how a bill got made. So I suggested first to Barney and then to Dodd, how about if I get into this as an insider? How about if you let me in from the beginning, let your staffs cooperate with me, you talk to me on a regular basis, let's see what happens. Barney jumped at this. I think it's what he had in mind. He was looking for what somebody thought would be sympathetic to record this historical event. Chris, who is perfectly understandable under his circumstances, was a slightly anxious candidate for re-election at this time and had a really lousy situation in Connecticut and was nervous. So he said he would cooperate wonderfully, but asked if he could approve whatever quotations I decided I would use from him before they went into the book. That seemed, under the circumstances, like a perfectly fair deal to me, and we struck it. In fact, in the end, after he had the wisdom to drop out of the re-election campaign, he agreed that he didn't have to check all these quotes, and everything went smoothly. So in the end, I had absolutely total cooperation, as far as I know. There may be something you want to disclose this afternoon that you haven't yet. But as far as I know, I got the whole story, or nearly. A couple of things that Barney didn't want to tell me that I found out about, one of which is intervention with Lloyd Blankfein, which we can talk about later, to help an undeserving citizen. But it went extremely well. For me, the most important question, wherever I've been stationed as a reporter, has always been, how does it really work? I got to ask this in the war in Vietnam. I got to ask it in the Soviet Union. I got to ask it in the Senate when I was the post reporter there for several years in the 70s. But it was a question that I knew had never really been well answered. And so that was my ambition when I set out to do this. And I was allowed to see it in a wonderful way through the eyes of Amy and Jean, who were introduced, and Eddie, and Dave Smith in the House, and many other aides, a number of them here present today, who kindly shared their time and their brain power and their observations with me. The result was that I was able to write a real adventure story, at least by my standards. And the nicest thing, which E.J. just did in a way again a minute ago, of the early compliments I've received from early readers, is people who say, hey, I really got swept up in your story. This was fun to read. But writing a thriller wasn't my ambition. My ambition was to explain the culture of the modern Congress. I wrote a piece about this that some of you saw in Sunday's Outlook section. I argued that today's culture on Capitol Hill is not at all sympathetic to creative problem solving. On the contrary, it's quite hostile. I want to talk for a few minutes about what I find in the culture of this Congress, and we can discuss a lot of this later if you'd like to. On the most obvious level, the modern Congress was redefined by competitive politics. Since 1994, when Newt Gingrich first led the Republicans back to power, every biennial election since has been an all-out contest for all the marbles. Control of Congress. We now live in an era of perpetual campaigning and constant political warfare. Warfare and perpetual campaigning cost a lot of money, of course, and the demand for money has had an enormous impact on Congress, and it's altered the culture of the Congress. It affects who runs for the job. Today's members have to spend at least a day or two of every week on the telephone, dialing for dollars, calling people, mostly strangers, to ask for money. Senator Dodd can tell us more about this. I'm guessing, but I don't think you miss those phone calls.
No.
Do you think James Madison would have made those calls? Do you think Howard Baker would have? Or Richard Bowling? Money has changed the makeup of Congress. We have a lot more wealthy members, and we have a lot of people who don't mind begging for money from strangers. Speaking of strangers, a lot of members of Congress are strangers from each other, which is a really peculiar feature of an institution composed of politicians. But if you leave your family at home, spend only 3 or 4 days a week in Washington, and your main preoccupation is partisan warfare, then you don't make friends across the aisle. Loyalty now runs to party, not to institutions, not to the House and Senate. Fear is the great motivator in Congress. I didn't understand this until I saw what happened in this case. Crises produce fear. The great crash produced a great crisis, and it produced a lot of fear in Congress. For most members, the greatest fear is that he or she will be blamed for the crisis. Blame avoidance is probably the first reflex on Capitol Hill. But a genuine crisis increases the political risks of inaction to the point where they can appear even greater than the risk of doing something, even if it proves to be imperfect. That reality helped Dodd-Frank. Congress is a reactive institution. It typically reacts in the modern age to proposals from the executive branch rather than taking initiatives of its own. This is not what the Founding Fathers expected, but it's now the normal procedure. I was a little naive about this. I really expected Dodd and Frank to be much more of the initiators than they turned out to be. Dodd tried, and maybe you'll tell a little bit about this. Initially, he made quite a radical proposal, including abolishing all the existing banking regulators and wrapping them into one new regulatory agency. His colleagues, without exception, all dumped on these ideas. So he had to follow Frank's lead eventually and accept the administration's framework as the template for reform. The preeminence of the executive branch, I realized, is made easier by the general decline of the expertise and policy experience in Congress. I wrote about this in Outlook, a triumph of politics over policy, as the great Lee Hamilton described it to me. Hamilton thought this had started to happen in the early 1980s. By now, the preeminence of politics over policy is obvious, and it's serious. On financial regulatory reform, of the 535 members of Congress, I don't think there were two dozen who had a really sophisticated understanding of the policy issues covered by the Dodd-Frank bill. And the number is even smaller today because both Dodd and Frank are gone. Their successors as chairman of the two committees are not remotely their equals. Non-expert members of Congress, I discovered, do a pretty poor job processing complicated legislation. In this case, a huge piece of legislation with fundamental consequences for the largest sector of the American economy passed through the House and Senate without ever being carefully dissected or debated. The Senate Banking Committee, for an odd reason you'll read about in the book or that Dodd may explain, never held a proper markup or section-by-section review of the bill. House Financial Services did review the legislation, but its markup was, to me, surprisingly cursory. The floor debates in both houses consisted mostly of rhetorical flourishes and political posturing. In the end, it seemed to me, most members had only the sketchiest notion of how the bill might all affect the financial sector or what was in it. as usual, all but a handful voted on party lines. In this case, Democrats, aye, Republicans, no. Another characteristic of this culture, which I think may be the most important, weak members empower staff. Staff run Capitol Hill. Ted Kennedy revealed this in his memoir, so he gave away the state secret. I quote him, 95% of the real nitty-gritty work on legislation is done by the staff. In my story, apart from Dodd and Frank personally, the people who did the most work and had the most influence on the legislation were women that almost no one in Washington has even heard of. And they're here today, Jean Roslanowick and Amy Friend. Jean was staff director of financial services. Amy was chief counsel of banking. They presided over the careful line-by-line vetting of legislation that members avoided. Staff of the Banking and Financial Services Committee spent literally thousands of hours on this bill, hearing out the pleadings of lobbyists, consulting with practitioners and experts, drafting legislative language, consulting with administration and Fed officials downtown, considering the political implications of various policy options, and more. In this case, I think they may have done more than 95% of the work. Another characteristic of the culture, which may seem counterintuitive, the fact that most members of the House and Senate are indifferent to policy, weak on substance, and ineffective at legislating doesn't seem to matter. As our politics have degenerated into tribal rivalry, the realities of budgets, tax policies, global warming, foreign military adventures and such don't often make an appearance in the one arena that our politicians still really care about, electoral politics. Elections today are almost never resolved on the basis of a serious debate on policy. Slogans, emotions, and 30-second TV spots are much more important. Even the smart, serious members, and there are quite a few, not a majority and not enough, but not a tiny number either, but they usually can't campaign themselves on the issues. They have to play the game too. Here is the most fundamental reality of the culture of Congress that I think I discovered here, and it's not a new discovery. This is an utterly human institution. It reflects a huge, vibrant, and diverse human society, the United States of America. Congress is representative in every sense of the word. It represents ignorance and emotion, crass materialism and moral corruption, as well as the nobler qualities of the electorate. We do not get a House and Senate any better than we are. In this case, I think the country was lucky. Dodd and Frank were remarkable leaders who managed to bring home an important bill. They were both crucial to the success of this enterprise and to my book, and I'm grateful as a citizen and as an author. But of course, neither of them will be around for us next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So, Senator Dodd, your revenge for Bob's theory that it's been all downhill since you were first elected in 1974 is to reveal how many of the quotes attributed to you were made up by Bob. I would love your response to Bob.
Well, first of all, let me thanks for inviting me to be a part and to be here at Brookings. It's a great thrill. Had an opportunity over the years to be invited here on various occasions, and it's nice to come back and to be with this very distinguished panel. Tom and I have known each other for years and years, going back to my House days with Richard Bowling, where I was his campaign manager for Majority Leader back in the 70s. And EJ, I've been a fan of yours, obviously, for years, and I got to know Bob. I've known him over the years, but never as closely as we got to know each other over the past couple of years. And you're right, there was some risk in doing this. I've been around long enough to know that if this bill did not become law, as we all know, defeat is an orphan. And there's only one name that would have been mentioned in the book, and that is the chairman of the Banking Committee for failing to get the bill done. Victory.
I think we would have had a book.
No, that'd be true. And Victory obviously has a lot of authors. I first of all was not enthusiastic about having my name on the bill, not because I don't like the bill or think it's a good bill. But I think it's so deceptive in describing a piece of legislation with two names on it when there were so many more people involved, including my colleagues, which I'll get to in a minute. In fact, I remember the night, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning when we were just finishing up the conference report on this bill that Congressman Ken Jorski, I remember very specifically the moment in Pennsylvania, who made the motion to call this bill the Frank Dodd bill. Barney, as always as a humorist, said, "Now you can't do that. They'll think it's one person if they call it Frank Dodd." And I said, no, Barney, don't try to pull the wool over my eyes. No one ever remembered Hawley's name, on Smoot Hawley, and of wretched memory, that particular trade piece of legislation back many decades ago. And the reason I say this, and I expressed an objection at the time, and it was obviously it's flattering, but historically it's kind of interesting that it's only in this area of law, it seems to me, that names are associated with bills. So you go back to Glass-Steagall, Sarbanes-Oxley most recently, Graham Leach Bliley. You can go back over history. There have been a lot of bills out of the financial area that have names on them. But I do think it doesn't serve up well, except for the purposes of identifying the legislation. I'll tell you that as a background and all that. In Bob's book, let me say, so there was some unease, obviously, in going forward on what was going to be a very precarious journey. People have been talking about reforming the financial architecture of the country for decades. The last time it really happened, of course, was in the 1930s. And so it was not a new idea, but typically, and I don't disagree with Bob's analysis, Congress is reactive. They don't normally step up and say, let's look over the landscape. What's an important issue we ought to deal with, whether or not it's on the public's mind or not? That's the history of the institution. And so prior to the events of 2007, 2008, there had been people talking about reforming the financial structure of the country, but there was never that engine of urgency that a crisis brings to a set of issues. And obviously the events of 2006, 2007, 2008, particularly 2008, all of a sudden created that window of opportunity. You never could have written this bill in 2006 or 2007, and you couldn't write it today because of, again, where the public's attention is, where the energy is. So there was this moment that arrived after the consideration of the TARP legislation that I thought warranted taking on the issue. Hank Paulson, in fact, I think in the spring of 07, leaked, if you will, to a major newspaper, his blueprint for what ought to be a financial reform package. The administration produced a white paper on the issue, which we looked at and considered, and an issue, despite my great affection for Bob, I'll take some issue in terms of being an administrative proposal. Most of the major provisions of this bill came out of the hearing process or other conversations, with the exception of the derivatives, the Volcker rule, and a couple of other things in the bill itself. So that was the moment in which we decided to move forward. Now, we had the health care bill coming up in between, and you began to do a hearing process. In 07, we had started the process. In fact, in 06, Senator Jim Bunning and Jack Reed, when they were in the majority, actually had hearings on the residential mortgage crisis. No one paid any attention to it in 06. In 07, when I became chairman, and I love Bob telling the story in 28 years, but sitting next to Joe Biden, Ted Kennedy, and Paul Sarbanes on three different committees, for 28 years, I never got close to being chairman. You either have to outlive or hope your colleagues get defeated in order to move up. This is not a meritocracy I served in at the time. And all of a sudden became chairman. In 07, we had some 90 hearings on the residential mortgage crisis, but we had a very slim majority. It was 49 Democrats, 2 independents, and 49 Republicans in January of 07, the thinnest of margins of moving forward. Almost no interest in the subject matter of the residential mortgage crisis. In fact, we had a hearing in February of 07, the first one, and a witness said he thought there might be 2 million foreclosures in the country. He was ridiculed the next day in the media for engaging in hyperbole, suggesting what the magnitude of the problem might be. Of course, we now look back and know there was hyperbole, only in the opposite direction. There were many more, obviously, foreclosures and more serious problems. And then in 08, you come into March, the weekend of St. Patrick's Day weekend, and you had the failure of Bear Stearns. Most argued then at the time it was a one-off problem, not of any great seriousness. And then it was 6 months later to the day, in September, when you had the AIG collapse, Lehman Brothers, and then, of course, the most critical meeting of all, the one that occurred about 7 p.m. in the conference room of Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, in which she invited...
Chapter one,
when she invited about 15 of us to be in the room with Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke. And Ben Bernanke proceeds to say the following almost verbatim, I would tell you, when he turned to the 15 of us in the room, or 16 in the room, and said, unless you act in a matter of days, the entire financial system of this country and a good part of the world will melt down. Needless to say, the oxygen left the room. Whether or not you agree with that analysis or not, this was not just some speech given by a casual observer. This is the most important central banker in the world telling the leadership of the Congress of the United States what he felt could happen if we did not act. As a result of that, we formed in the Senate a very bipartisan group made of people like Bob Bennett and Judd Gregg, Chuck Schumer, myself, Jack Reed, and others, and wrote the TARP legislation, far more comprehensive than the 2.5 pages that Hank Paulson sent us at 1:30 in the morning, where he said, give me $700 billion, no court, no regulator could intervene. That was the beginning of the bipartisanship on drafting what became the Dodd-Frank legislation, out of that crucible. The Senate passed that bill 75-24, about 40 days before the national election. On the night of the vote, I asked the Senate, through Harry Reid, to make members vote from their chairs. I thought it was that significant a moment, comparable to, in a sense, a Supreme Court nomination or a constitutional amendment, when senators vote from their chairs. But I went around the chamber to various members that night who were up for re-election in 40 days. And I told them I had the votes necessary to pass the TARP legislation. But I also knew many would lose their seats if they voted for it. I'll never forget Gordon Smith, Republican senator from Oregon, that I went up to and told Gordon we had the votes, that I appreciated his support, but if he wanted to vote otherwise, I would never mention his name in the process. I would understand the politics of it. And I'll never forget his answer, because I think these stories don't get told enough. He said to me, it's a great offer, I really appreciate it, but I got to face a constituent tomorrow, and I don't know how to explain my vote. And I said, well, who do you have to see in the morning? And his answer was, and I'll never forget it, he said, the mirror, because I happen to believe this is the right thing to do for the country. He voted for it and, of course, lost his election 40 days later. He was not alone in that reaction. And I wish stories like that were more repeated more often, because it is the noble stories. The job of the media, obviously, is to report about planes that don't fly. But every day there are ones that do in the Congress of the United States, rarely celebrated, in my view, and yet they happen all the time. The drafting of the bill, and I'm very appreciative of Bob going through this, because it is an important story on how a bill as complicated as this works its way through, and it is difficult. I had the Herculean job of producing 60% of the votes in the United States Senate. Now, I had numbers to work with, but it's a huge number to try to get to on something this complicated. Anything of this side, the safest vote is always no. I know there will always be things wrong with it, and you can identify those issues if you want. So we went forward, and here's the point I'd like to make. One, we had an incredible staff, and obviously Amy and Jean and so many others played, Eddie Silliman, people who did a remarkable job pulling this together. It was also very much a member-driven process. I did something that was done not often enough, I suspect. We did it on the health care bill, which I was deeply involved in with the death of my closest friend in the Senate, Ted Kennedy. And I did it in the banking bill. And that was to divide up the labor between Democrats and Republicans. I announced in a meeting in the Foreign Relations Committee where I brought the members, both Republicans and Democrats, together, and I assigned responsibilities. I asked Jack Reed to work with Judd Gregg on the derivative section of the bill. I asked Chuck Schumer to work with Mike Crapo on the corporate governance part of the bill. I asked Mark Warner and Bob Corker to work on too big to fail provisions of the bill. And so they divided up and began to work on this. This is where member involvement was critical. Do they become co-authors, if they could, on major sections of what we're trying to craft in the legislation? I followed a bit of the white paper, obviously, the White House had produced, but also something I didn't announce a lot. The G20 in April of 2008 had made a series of 20 recommendations that they felt were necessary for harmonization of global rules in the financial services sector. And I felt very strongly that it was important that we try to develop harmonization, that the United States ought to lead, but that we also ought to set up a set of guidelines that might be adopted, particularly by the European community. I'll just say as an aside very quickly, this was hard to do because you're primarily dealing with Europe and the United States. But the next crisis, when it comes, and it will involve far more than just Europe and the United States. It will involve India, it will involve Brazil, it will involve China. And if we don't end up with some harmonization of rules, it will be almost impossible to put the genie back in the bottle when it comes to globalization or harmonization of financial rules. That was very much a guiding view of mine as we went forward in drafting the legislation. So I will be eternally grateful to Democrats and Republicans on the committee, even though we didn't get as much support. Bob Corker, to his great credit, stepped up and decided he wanted to be a part of the efforts. Richard Shelby, who I have great affection for personally, we're very, very good friends, for reasons he'd have to explain. I've never really asked him the direct question. Why not? I have my own views and ideas, but it may be better to hear from him on why he decided not to necessarily be as a constructive part of the crafting of the bill. Bob Bennett, who sat next to him from Utah, had done a remarkable job, in my view, the peso crisis issues earlier, and a very constructive, conservative Republican member of the Senate. But he was facing a dreadful political situation in Utah, where he was being threatened with his political life if he were involved in any sort of a bipartisan bill. Jim Bunning sat next to him, who had his own views on financial services, and being polite and all of this. And then you had Mike Crapo. And I had to get down the line. Then I had Vitter and DeMint and so forth on the committee as well. It was hard on that side to put together a working group in terms of might step up. But Bob Corker did, and I'm grateful to him. So that was very much a part of what we moved forward. At the end of the day, when you go through, we had 60 amendments considered on the floor of the Senate. Went on for about 10 days, that debate. And again, Bob, I disagree. This wasn't just a lot of puffery. There were serious amendments adopted. And there were some 10 Republicans who contributed very directly to this bill, one quarter of the Republican conference. Not every idea was incorporated. But the things like the federal oversight, the federal stability oversight, that idea came out of a hearing that we had. The whole idea of FDIC to do the resolution authority was objected to by the administration because Sheila Bair and the administration had difficulties with each other. The idea that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau would be constructed the way it was, where it was again a Republican idea, but also we had disagreements with the administration over that. And down the line, the Office of Financial Resources was, again, an idea that came out of Mark Warner, working with Bob Corker at incorporating the bill, which is now up and running. So major parts, too big to fail. That was a Shelby Dodd amendment that got 90 votes on the floor of the Senate as the very first amendment that was considered. So a lot of this bill, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Susan Collins, Sam Brownback, Dick Lugar, all wrote major portions and significant parts of this bill. It's not widely known. So while they're actual who voted for it and yet who was involved in crafting it is far more reflective of that effort than the outcome would certainly dictate as you look at just the names on those who voted yes and those who voted no. So it's important to note. It's a labor intensive, and as Bob points out, a lot of it is personally spending time with people. I spent countless hours with colleagues. Sitting down and listening to them, their ideas and thoughts, what they needed to have part of this bill to make it work. Did I agree with all of them? No. And I find it frustrating when I hear and read, with all due respect to, again, columnists, who will say we went too far, or we didn't go far enough. Putting together 60 votes in the Senate, when you have 535 members of Congress, an administration, regulators, the media, and stakeholders, on something this complex, it requires a great deal of effort, and you don't get to have your way on everything. You have to try and work your best to bring votes to the table. I'll just end with one anecdote. I've been asked about the Volcker Rule on countless occasions over the last several years and why we ended up with a 3% in the Volcker Rule. I told Bob this story. Well, I tell you, this is a very important moment, and again, it's a very significant outcome. And I gathered together the best economists in the world to sit down and talk about proprietary
trading. Can you explain the 3% for those who haven't read the book yet?
Well, I will. Let me finish the story, and I'll explain the 3%. But the point was proprietary trading. This is what gambling with depositors' money, in effect, for the financial institution's benefit. And Paul Volcker thought this was something that ought to be reformed. The president agreed with him, and so we were trying to fix this. And there were those, as we sat down, who felt that the Volcker Rule shouldn't be changed at all. There were some who thought that a bank 10% of their resources ought to be allowed to be invested in proprietary trading. Others thought there should be zero. You shouldn't allow a nickel of these resources to be spent in that particular area. But I could get 60 votes for three. Now, I know that's not a terribly intellectual argument for you, but when you're trying to write a bill, you have to keep that in mind. Had I decided to make it zero or 10, I might have lost one vote. That's all I had to lose was one vote. Lose one of the 60 votes, bill's over, day's over, and we'd be sitting around talking about what might have been with a financial reform bill. And again, I'm having spent a time up there and watching good members over the years, it makes a difference. So the 3%, that's where that came from, so it tolerates at least as we wrote it. Now, the regulators are working at this, obviously, and it's taking a long time to get the Volcker Rule done, but it is a complex and very important provision, and allowing an institution to hedge against certain things like interest rates and so forth is actually, in my view, permissible. It should be permissible. But there's a debate about where that number ought to be that's ongoing, E.J., I would say to you. Lastly, on the issue of how many members understand these issues, financial services historically have not been a comfortable area for most people. It's not an exciting area of law to get involved in. When you start talking about derivatives and swaps, and you start talking about all sorts of questions involving the proprietary trading and so forth, this normally doesn't attract a wide following of your constituents in the country. But the members of Congress are not technocrats. They're legislators. In the space of 09 and 10, you were dealing, as I think EJ or you, Bob, pointed out, with both the health care bill, financial reform. I was involved during that two-year period. I managed on the floor of the Senate the U.S.-India nuclear accords. I managed the mental health parity bill. I wrote the legislation giving the FDA authority control over tobacco products in the country. I wrote the Iran sanctions legislation, the Daniel Pearl legislation regarding the State Department's chronicling media representatives who are in harm's way in the world, as well as, of course, after Senator Kennedy got sick, the health care bill and this. Now, again, I'm not claiming that I was a great expert on India or mental health issues or the like, but you get responsible jobs to try and manage pieces of legislation through the process. And members of Congress do their very best. The best ones, in my view, carve out areas where they develop a real expertise, even if the issue is not the most important issue of the day. But invariably, these matters come up. When I think back on it, obviously, a Russell Long on taxation or Bob Dole on taxes, Sam Nunn on defense issues, for instance, comes to mind. Teddy Kennedy, obviously, on health issues and related matters. So I think if I were offering any lessons to today's members, it would be to do that. I said last thing, but I want to make one more point to you.
He is a senator.
I disagree with. I want to just take issue because this is the one thing that I really do disagree with. The Senate and the Congress, there's not any straight line trajectory on the Senate heading and the Congress in a great direction or a bad direction. It is more, if you had to graph it out, more like a wave. There have been brilliant periods, and there have been periods that are dreadful patches. And we're in a very bad patch right now. But let me make an historical argument for you. And I thought a lot about this, since so much has been written about it. I would argue that the 1950s may have been the worst decade in the 20th century for the United States Senate. It was the era of Joe McCarthy. There was a lot of finger-pointing that went on. People's patriotism, their loyalty to the country was raised in question by a sitting powerful members of the Senate. It was not a pretty decade, to put it mildly. The 1960s, I would argue, at least for a good part of them, may have been the most important 7 or 8 years in the 20th century for the Senate. The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Title I education, a remarkable period. There were three elections, 58, 60, and 62. There were 24 new members elected in those six elections, 11 of them of the same party. So they only had basically 11 seats that changed hands. And yet if you compare the 1950s and the 1960s, two decades juxtaposed to each other, you get totally different readings about their performance. Now, a lot of things happened, obviously. The assassination of an American president. A vice president becomes president, knows the institution, manages to muscle things through to get things done. But things are always happening in our country. And so before people run and decide that it's never going to get better, this is the worst time ever, in a sense, we need to remind ourselves there have been other periods, and they come back. And each generation has to discover how it operates and functions in its time, in a sense. Dealing with today, the modern technologies that exist and information, and I totally agree, the awesome and dreadful responsibility of raising money that you have to get elected or reelected. But I want us to be careful about rushing to judgment too quickly There are some remarkably good new members, in my view, Democrats and Republicans in the Senate. And I think, given the opportunities and circumstances, will rise to the occasion, just as other generations have. Unfortunately, we're living in a time where the franchise of public service is being so denigrated on an hourly basis, it's hard to get anyone to say anything positive about it at all. And nothing more infuriating to me is now someone watching the institution to see the demeaning process. We ought to be celebrating people, regardless of their politics, if they're willing to be involved in the public discourse and debate of our country. And not enough of that happens, in my view. Now, I'm not going to be a Pollyanna about all of this, but I do see the institution made up of quality members coming back under different circumstances to make a difference. So while I accept certainly the critical observations about this at all, I think you need to have a deeper, longer historical view about the institution. See the quality of the members that exist today, that are there, and recognize they too will find their moment and come back. They just did it on immigration, or about to, in my view. I think they will on some other issues. What Chuck Schumer did with Orrin Hatch and others on finding that compromise, allowing them to go forward, I think we'll begin to see a better day. So I want to end on a positive note, EJ, that I'm not as down on the institution. And I realize all of the things that have been said about it, but I also believe this current membership can have some very, very significant moments and write equally as good, if not better, legislation than Barney and Frank did. I did this on the financial reform.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah. I think Senator Dodd just took the most unpopular position ever taken in this building. He defended the Congress of the United States. Thank you very, very much. Tom.
Well, this is a treat. It's certainly a treat for me to listen to Bob and Chris, and it's a treat for you. There is a lot here that is of real interest, importance, and relevance, and I want to underscore a couple of pieces of it to make sure it just didn't whip by you. First, to be clear about what I think of Bob Kaiser's book, he sent me page proofs. It was off to production, so it was too late to go on the back cover. He just sent it to me, and I read it, believe it or not, on vacation. Not a novel. I read his book in Tucson, Arizona. And as soon as I finished, I got out my computer, and I wrote this email to him. And it said, Act of Congress is easily the best book on Congress I have read in decades. It is a stupendous achievement, richly informative, a pleasure to read, wise in its assessments of why Dodd-Frank was able to succeed and how this case is more exception than rule in these difficult governing times. And I ended by saying generations of students will find it their favorite and most rewarding assigned reading in classes. Bob's book reads like a novel. And let me tell you, Thomas Mann knows what novels read like. It's much more interesting than and informative than sitting through the series of hearings that Chris Dodd had to sit through and Barney Frank had to sit through and the difficult conference that they have to get through. But by conveying the richness of the interactions and the participants, one comes away, and congressional scholars who never get that close will come away with a new and appreciated understanding of this institution and this broader process. But the book also contains a serious analytic treatment of Congress as an institution within a political context, and that's important. The last chapter is called Still Broken, and that's where he develops this notion of the problem is the culture of Congress. Now, here I want to make an argument that his emphasis on the culture of Congress turns eyes away from other things that he says that I think are more consequential and important. Just remember, the culture of Congress didn't change between the 111th and 112th Congress, but it's day and night. It's because the context was dominating. The Republican House made it impossible for anything to happen. I would argue the culture is more a symptom of what's going on, and with it comes a whole set of problematics and consequences. But it's clear what's driving the culture that he is talking about in this book is the emergence of partisan polarization, which came after that great period of the Golden Senate that Chris Dodd referred to, in which there was no overlap that a leader could work with in the other party, because everyone was absolutely apart. Secondly, during that period of time, the Democrats were in control big time, large majorities. The House and the Senate Democrats had been in control since Eisenhower's first term, first Congress. And frankly, Republicans were kind of tame. They realized if they were going to get anything done, they had to do business with Democrats. And a lot of them, a class of problem-solving conservative or moderate Senate Democrats, made a huge difference. And there were a good number in the House as well. Republicans, excuse me. But when we got to parity, first with the Senate, with the 1980 election, when Chris was elected, and then the 1994 election, suddenly either party could win a majority. And that's what turned, I think, members of Congress, many of them, from being problem solvers and legislators to politicians. Because they were under such pressure, saying, well, this one piece of legislation, this one amendment, could be the wedge issue that determines if we're in the majority or not. And the final, which Bob talks about but didn't say a word of during the presentation here, I will quote from Kaiser in the Washington Post, "The biggest change in American politics in my lifetime has been the transformation of the Republican Party." And he says it in great detail, and it is a reality that you've got to face up to, and it enormously complicates the task of governing. So I don't disagree with any of certainly Bob's rich description or his analysis. It's all there. I just think he slightly underemphasized some of it by talking about the culture of Congress, which is safe in the world of the press today, because then you don't seem to be imbalanced in your treatment. Now, Bob isn't like that, but many of his colleagues at the Washington Post and the New York Times and others do that. Now let me turn to Chris here. Chris Dodd is genuinely a man of the Senate. This was far from the first major bill that he passed. He has a record mainly on the Labor Committee of family and medical leave, immunization, daycare, a whole host of issues that he has worked in. And you can find the same thing in the area of foreign policy and the early banking activities that we talked about. He's made a difference many times. So we should remain optimistic. He's been a part of getting things done, and he even got something done since Congress changed and the Senate changed in really such a fundamental way. But I kept asking myself, did Chris really believe he could cut a deal with Shelby and make it stick when Mitch McConnell had announced at the beginning of the year, forget it, we Republicans aren't playing ball? And I thought it was brilliant to put together the pairs of senators on the committee, and they did good work. But we noticed not a single one of them voted for the final bill. Sure, if they can have a hand in influencing a bill, but then walk away from it. If you hadn't managed to put together the three Republicans that you did from the Northeast and somehow keep the queasy Democrats on board, and you did so much work to do that, their absence would have led to a complete failure. So I'm not quite as bullish on the Republicans as Chris is. It's a tough job in this environment when the filibusters, which used to be the exception, then became a little more frequent. In fact, it tracked Chris's career. And then just it took off like a rocket in 2009, and everything was subject to a 60-vote threshold. Many things that got done in earlier times wouldn't have happened under this environment, and it's why some big things managed to happen in the 111th that had no chance in the 112th or 13th, and all of the reporting about what Obama did or didn't do was largely irrelevant to the reality that the context has changed. We got the stimulus, the Affordable Care Act, Dodd-Frank, the 111th. We got the pseudo-crisis over the debt ceiling and the public downgrade of our debt in the 112th and the sequester in the 113th. I sort of rest my case. What I want to say is I agree with Chris over Bob on staff. That is to say, strong members who are serious about legislating need really good staff. And you tell that story and you say it, that one of the real tales of this is the extraordinary work done by key House and Senate staff. But members who are unformed wouldn't have been able to make use of them in that fashion, and then to work it into the broader process. So, yeah, I'm saying if we have a lot of members who aren't informed, and we do, and if we have a lot of silly talk on the floor that's pure soundbite and prepared lines repeated again and again, thank God we have some able people who care about the institution. I'm just worried we don't substitute for Gene and Amy a bunch of ideologues who don't achieve the expertise and work to try to develop legislation that has a shot at it. Thank you.
Thank you. I know there are a lot of people in the audience who have some real expertise here, so I just want to confine myself to a couple of questions. I do want to report the most interesting new organization I learned of from this book. Only in Washington, D.C. would we create the Coalition for Derivatives End Users, which Bob describes. And in fact, I never expected a book to make the battle over derivatives look like a cliffhanger affair. It's a really fascinating story. It really, truly is. Don't take my word for it. Read the book. Bob and I have a long-standing argument, which I don't want to get into, which is I am temperamentally skeptical of golden age theories of any institution. I was thinking, as Bob was talking about the campaign process, you know, Richard Nixon ran against the Pink Lady. George Smathers in the late 40s, 1950, attacked his opponent for having a sister who was a thespian. Yes, she was an actress.
He matriculated in college.
Yes,
Yes,
it was a vicious campaign. I mean, we've had, and so I don't want to get into that, but I just want to sort of put that out there because, and if Bob wants to defend a golden age theory, I'll let him. But I wanted to ask sort of related questions to Bob and Senator Dodd. When you look at this whole story and examine the various compromises that were made, I'd love you to talk a little bit about where you think the bill was harmed, if you will, by necessary compromise. We were talking about the 3% rule. 3% was the lowest you could go and still hold Scott Brown's vote on the derivatives. So I'd like you to sort of reflect on that. And Senator Dodd, I want to ask a similar question, two questions really. One is, how different would this bill have been if you could have passed it with 51 votes? Do you have some thoughts, a couple of examples of what you might have done differently, but just how would that process have been different? Would it have been better or worse? And have you changed your mind at all about the filibuster? You have up to now been a defender of the existing rule, and Bob suggests in the book that you were getting pretty impatient with it, and that was before the last year. So I'd like to ask you those two questions, but Bob, if you could talk a bit about, you know, going through all of this, where did you see the necessary compromises potentially doing damage to the bill?
Let me say first, I too don't believe in golden ages, but I believe in more golden and less golden ages. And we're in a less golden one at the moment. You know, this question raises what for me has been a tricky problem throughout. I am not, and never have been, an expert on financial regulation. I've had some wonderful teachers, many of them in this room, who helped me understand the issues here. But I really don't know, to this day, with one exception that I'm going to mention, where there's a weak spot in this bill, or where there's something that's really wrong. And I think, as Chris and Barney both said to me in different ways, we're really only going to know for sure when we have another crisis and see what works. Because a lot of these provisions are taking on hypothetical problems that have never actually arisen. The one really interesting, egregious case, and that I'd like to hear Chris talk about it, I didn't press him on it before, was the compromise he felt he had to make, that it was never a compromise, nothing ever happened, and that was the compromise. It was with Blanche Lincoln, who was running for re-election, and Democrats desperately wanted to help her in every way they could, for the obvious reason that they needed every seat they could get. And because of this, some really bad language on derivatives is still in the bill. Julie Chan, the key staffer who taught me all this, is in the third row here.
He made you a real hero. I was finishing the book last night and wanted to meet you after reading this.
Worth meeting. So Julie was driven to distraction by this because she knew what was wrong and nothing could be done about it. And they kept hoping at this instance, maybe in the conference committee, there would be a chance to fix it, and there never was. So I'm sure that from a critical analysis of the text of the bill, the worst provision is the derivatives provision, and it's because of this political accident. The other compromises that I know about and wrote about all seem to be justifiable. This question of 3%, 10%, nobody has any idea. And, you know, Volcker had this wonderful line, proprietary trading, which means a bank playing the markets with its own money. Proprietary trading is very hard to define, said Volcker in the hearing in your committee, but I know it when I see it. Right? Potter Stewart.
That Potter Stewart. Pornography.
That's a little too glib, frankly. Yeah. It's, in fact, extremely difficult to say this transaction is proprietary and this one is not. And that's what the regulators are struggling with now, trying to write the Volcker rule as a functioning regulation. So it was a compromise. It wasn't what Paul Volcker wanted, but he accepted it. And I think it's fine. I think it's okay. And then the other ones are all similar. The biggest compromise that was made from the outset here, which I write about, but don't dwell on, both Chris and Barney, for their own reasons, decided at the outset that they were not interested in a revolutionary reconstruction of the financial sector of the United States. They were not interested in breaking up the big banks. They were not interested in restoring Glass-Steagall. And that's a good argument about that. There is not an open and shut case, in my opinion, for restoring Glass-Steagall. So they did something which the liberal activists said was a cop-out, which they can defend very articulately, and Chris will if he wants to. But it was a big, big compromise not to do what FDR and Ben Cohen and that gang decided to do, which was really shake up the existing realities, change them, make them different than they were. They built on a system that existed. They did not transform it. It's very different now. It's a lot less profitable than it was, but it's recognizably the same system. And I think that was very much a product of the politics of the situation, but also the preferences of the two chairmen and the administration. Everybody was on the same page on this. So that's enough for that.
Well, a couple of points. I mean, an awful lot said there. Regarding the big banks, let me pick up the last point. In fact, when we established the Financial Services Oversight Board, we gave them extraordinary power. This institution never existed. And part of this was, my thinking on this was, and it came up in the hearing process where someone made the suggestion, we developed the idea and the staff working on this proposal, was that there's nothing in this legislation that prohibits the next crisis. They will happen. The question is, can we get a tourniquet on the problem before it metastasizes into what this problem became? In my view, had there been in 06 or 07 a response to the residential mortgage crisis, it would have been a crisis, but far less of one than what emerged as a result of failing to address the problem when the opportunity existed. So the idea of the federal oversight is obviously to have an organization made up of the Treasury and the various other regulatory bodies that meet regularly. And again, there was some upset reactions at Treasury when they weren't going to necessarily chair that. That was a disagreement we had. But to meet periodically and look over the horizon and say, what's occurring out there? Are institutions taking on greater risk than they ought to? Are there product lines emerging which could pose significant risk and the like? And you can begin to react to them instead of waiting for something to actually grow to such a larger problem that all of a sudden you're faced with these dreadful alternatives that we were in the fall of 2008. And so it was very, very important in my view that we have that capacity, and that was an example of that ability. But all 60 amendments, with the exception of one on the floor of the Senate, I insisted that everyone be accepted or rejected on a 50-vote margin, and everyone was, except one. Which 60 votes, and because of those who were involved and insisted upon it, and it actually carried, even with the 60 votes, the amendment did. And the reason I did, and I let people talk in the Senate, unless they got so dilatory in the process that I'd call them on it. And to their great credit, very few did, that I ever had to call anyone on it. But never, I wanted to be able to prove that you could take a major bill, you could actually debate it in a full-throated way in the floor of the Senate, and that you could actually then vote up or down with 50 votes on it. The final bill required a 60-vote margin to pass the legislation, unfortunately. So the question of what would have happened had been 51 votes. The question I've often asked is if I had had four or five, six, seven, eight Republicans decided they wanted to work on the bill, not to rewrite the bill, but to work on the bill itself with a little more freedom than they were being given by the leadership,
right.
Then I think the bill might have been different in the derivatives area, for instance, a little bit. Maybe in the Volcker rule a little bit here and there. It's hard to say exactly where the changes would have occurred. And it was disappointing to me. And I did try to reach out to amendments to people. And to her credit, Susan Collins wanted to write some provisions in the bill, cared enough about it. We incorporated her ideas, and she voted for the bill. Olympia Snow cared about small business, had some provisions in that. We worked those into the bill, and she supported the bill. Sam Brownback had amendments dealing with the Congo. Dick Lugar did. Dealing with extractive industries and so forth. You could argue because it involved corporate governance to some degree, but nonetheless, unfortunately, didn't support the bill in the end. I mentioned some of the earlier provisions as well, EJ, that where we incorporated ideas. So I regretted in the end. Normally in a process, having been through many of them over the years, that in the minority, if you get provisions in the bill, and significant ones, you may not like everything else, but your inclination is then to be supportive that a major idea of yours has been incorporated. That didn't happen. I regret that didn't happen. But I do think it's important when talking about the history of the legislation that there are significant provisions in that bill that were crafted and written by the minority. And that's not insignificant, in my view. Now, the filibuster. And I'll be quick on this one. I've served under every imaginable configuration that you can in Congress and a White House. in 30 years, every imaginable one, where I was in the majority, the minority, the House, the majority, minority, presidents, Republicans, Democrats, as if it were a Rubik's Cube, and you could move it around in every possible configuration I served under at one time or another. And I'm a great believer that the bicameral idea, which was created by two wonderful senators from Connecticut, Oliver Sherman and Roger Sherman, Oliver Ellsworth, that saved the Constitutional Convention in the 18th century, had the right idea that the House, the rules, absolutely guarantee the rights of majority. I served there, served on the Rules Committee with Dick Bowling, great believer in that. The brilliant idea that down the hall we created another body that would have equal representation of all states and where the rights of a minority, including a minority of one, would be sacrosanct in many ways, forcing the institution, the Congress, to deliberate and think about things before there was a tyranny of the majority that can happen. And having served under all these different configurations, I always find it somewhat interesting that those who are in the majority want to get rid of the filibuster to get their ideas done. Go spend a few years in the minority, and let me tell you, you want to get rid of it when ideas come along that are dreadful, could do great damage to the country. And so this is a rough period we're in, and I agree with that. I don't disagree. Saddens me to watch it. But I also, as I said earlier, have a lot of confidence it can come around and come back. And when it does, I hope you don't confront a United States Senate that's been basically so neutered in the process, it looks like a unicameral process here. Just a mirror reflection of the House of Representatives. The Senate operates on unanimous consent. With all the other rules you have, it's the willingness of the members of the institution to make it work. And right now what you've had in three times in the 20th and early part of the 21st century, in 1948, you saw it again in 1981, and you're seeing it now. And that is where you have almost supermajorities made up of first-term senators. It happened in 48, between 44 and 48, happened between 76 and 81, and it's happening today. Next year, the next Congress comes, automatically you're going to have 54 senators in their first term. That's if no one else is defeated in the process. Could be more, depending on the outcome of the election. When you end up with that kind of a distortion, with so many new members and fewer members who've been around longer, it's the discipline of the institution that moderates the behavior of new members in some ways, so that you end up with more of a flow of new and old members coming in. I'm not suggesting longevity in every case, but did you get a flow? A certain amount of members have been around a while, new members come in. And you learn the rhythms of the institution. It's not governed by rules per se, but rather the willingness of 100 people to sit together to try and achieve some common point of view and to then drive it effectively to get there. I take some great pride in the last few weeks that I was in the Senate. There was a survey done, not from me, and it asked the colleague members of the Senate, who's the most partisan member of the Senate and who's the most bipartisan member of the Senate? I won both polls. Go figure. And I don't object to the outcome in some ways because I happen to believe that some of the best senators historically were people who believed very deeply what they cared about and were willing to fight for it, but also were smart enough to figure out how to come to a compromise to get something done in a way. So I know that there's a temptation in these frustrations with the nominations. I think you ought to look about who gets confirmation. I'm wondering whether or not you have to have Senate confirmation of ambassadors and a lot of other things today. They're not planning potentiary any longer. They can communicate with each other on cell phones minute by minute with the State Department. You can begin to look at how you might reduce the number of Senate confirmations and reduce the number of filibusters that occur. But I just urge people not to get so caught up in the moment that you're willing to fundamentally alter what has been a critically important institution, where the rights of a minority, the debate that occurs, and thinking carefully about what we're about to do. Frustrating as it is, I think changing it, as some have suggested, would be a great loss.
Can I just, I wanted to pull these numbers on just this question. Bob notes that as recently as the Congress of 1969-70, fewer than 15 cloture motions were filed in the Senate. In the 80s, they never exceeded 60 in one Congress. After the Democrats regained control in 2007 and 2008, they shot up to 139 in the 110th Congress and 137th. Yeah. Hasn't this changed already? In other words, you're saying you like the same way the Senate works, but the Senate doesn't work like it did anyway. In other words, this is a wholly new world.
Well,
and
again,
I wanted to ask Bob what he thought about the filibuster, but I want to ask you first.
I can't argue with any of those numbers. I understand them. But what you're asking me to accept is because we're going through this, and those numbers are dreadful, that you're going to take an institution that's given us the kind of protections against some very bad ideas historically,
because there was a place where you had to think twice about what you were doing. To me, you give that up, and you lose a great deal. I said it depends on where you sit on whether or not you think these are great rules. Abuse of them, I think, are terrible. But again, the leadership and the ability of people to know each other, something you or Bob pointed out, which I find one of the worst conditions, and that is you've got a staggering number of people now who arrive here on Monday night or Tuesday mornings and leave Thursday nights or Friday mornings. They don't know each other at all. That's no institution, public or private, survives where there is not the kind of social interaction critical for its success. And what's happening here is the only thing people know about each other is what party they belong to or what ideology they embrace. They don't know what they care about, what their kids care about, what their hobbies are, all those basic things that any institution needs if you're going to be successful. And to me, that does an awful lot of damage to the process, that people don't know each other. When I arrived, I think I'm about right, you can check on this, the United States government paid for 2 round-trip tickets a year to your state. And after that, you wanted to go home, you paid for them out of your own pocket on the thing. Now, there was a value in that, I might say. You got elected to Congress. You didn't get elected to the city council back in the town you're from. And you're supposed to come here and spend the time. Instead of going back, now you can go back. If you can think of a reason to see 3 people that have some public purpose on a Saturday morning, the federal government will pay you a round-trip air ticket to go do it, in a sense. That's ludicrous, in my view, here. You need to be able to say to people, you want to go back home and do that, pay for it out of your campaign account or pay for it personally, if that's what you want to do. But people need to spend time here. You've got now, 70 or 80 House members living in their offices. And I regret they don't bring their families to town. And many of them can't afford to. I realize it's expensive. But just that alone could have a fundamental alteration on those numbers that you're talking about.
Bob, I want to go to the audience. Do you have any thoughts on the filibuster at the end of this?
One quick thought. Chris said the key thing. The Senate operated when it operated well on the unanimous consent rule because of a shared loyalty to the institution. And I'm afraid that that's what's been lost.
I agree.
That the loyalty now is to party, not to institution, as I said. And the difference is profound. And therefore, I'm more sympathetic, although I haven't seen the perfect solution yet, to the idea that it could be changed.
Thank you. Please. Sir.
Please identify yourself.
Everyone, please identify themselves. Thank you, sir.
I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to push on this point where I think we are now, and that is, as I look on the stage and points of view that have been articulated from Bob Kaiser talking about the greatest change has been in his time of watching Congress has been the change in the character of the modern Republican Party, and Tom and Norm's book about it's worse than it looks, and Senator Dodd's point about we might call it the baby and bathwater argument, is all good and well, but sort of going back to Potter Stewart's notion about it, I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it. I suspect every one of us sees it. My question is to either or Mr. Kaiser or Senator Dodd, if we could agree that it ain't working, and it ain't working because it is that too many changes have taken place, so that the character of the Senate that your father knew and that you knew when you came in, as an example, is gone. What nominations would we make from this panel of changes that could be made, and that in either the House or the Senate, that would make some difference, that would nudge us towards, if not a golden era, a less corrosive one than we're in. I'm just interested to know, what's the realm of the possible here, because it seems to me that this is not a time to follow Ronald Reagan's, don't just stand there, do nothing, or whatever the hell it is. So anyway, that's my point.
Thank you.
You mentioned Reagan, and that's, for me, that's where this starts, is Reagan's first inaugural. The government is not the problem. It is not the solution. The government is the problem. we have cultivated over the last 40 years a hostility to government in our culture. It's never been absent. It's been there from the beginning. But its intensity has increased dramatically in modern times. And the result is that really a majority of the new members of the 112th, 113th Congresses, I think, don't believe in the efficacy of government. They think government is something only to be shrunk, and that they see no good coming from it. This is a perfectly acceptable philosophical proposition, but if that's the membership of your governing legislature, you're not going to get much good government, and that's where we are. So I think, unfortunately, I'm asked this everywhere on my book tour now, how do we solve this? What's the only real solution I can recommend with a straight face is that we've got to again develop a sense of citizen involvement in public life in this country that has been absent for quite a while. Why do people put up with the money issue? Why is there no popular revulsion against the obvious buying of our political system by the rich and the powerful? And you can't debate that. That's happened. So where's the uproar? Where's the revolt? Until we see one, we're in trouble.
Well, I'd mention a couple of things. The money issue, Bob has articulated, having been through it and through eight elections and over the years, nine elections actually. There is clearly a corrosive quality to it. And it's not so much I worry about people becoming wholly bought subsidiaries, whoever ran the campaign. It's the amount of time spent more than anything else. I worry more about that, where you literally have these watching members having to go day after day and making calls to raise the money. That is so debilitating, in my view. But let me mention a couple of things that I think would have value. One, you're already seeing some change in California and Iowa, for instance. And I'll go back to the notion of the reapportionment and deciding, drawing congressional lines, the old gerrymandering process going back again to the 18th century. But to me, you're getting to the point where I think there are only about 40 House seats that you could actually call competitive in the sense where you have a Democrat or Republican could win based on arguments. The rest of them are you worry about your primary and that's it. And so that you're getting people, it has a tendency to have just the opposite effect of what should be happening. It's forcing people to the extremes rather than bringing people closer. Listening to minority voices is very important. I even regret to some degree that the new modern campaigns, which we saw in the last one, can become so scientific that when you go to Elm Street to go door to door, you now only have to go to two or three doors because, you know, all the rest of them are either for you or against you, and you never have to listen to them. And so you're only going to those that might vote for you. And I think it's very valuable to open a door and knock on a door and have someone open it up and tell you how wrong they think you are. I think that's very valuable in the political process. And if you eliminate that to a large extent, if you don't have to listen to what other people think about an idea because you're only talking to your own, yourself or your own audience, then I think we suffer. So readjusting those lines, I think, could do a tremendous amount. The money question as well, I think, is critically important. And then, again, just this notion of, I don't think you can falsely build into the institution the kind of camaraderie by creating sort of happy hours and so forth. I mean, I think there's a phoniness to that that has to happen more legitimately. I just tell you one quick story that sort of anecdotes in a way. My first week in the United States Senate, and I arrived, there was a lunchroom that unfortunately in my last few years in the Senate, I used to take all the new members down and show them this room where we used to have lunch every day. A table for the Democrats, a table for the Republicans. No one was religiously lived by those two tables. You kind of mixed it up. But you couldn't bring staff. You couldn't bring your family. You're just members. And I walk in there my first week, and I go over to the Democratic table, and there's Pat Moynihan and Ted Kennedy and Scoop Jackson all sitting around, a variety of Fritz Hollings, all sitting around the table, others giants in the Senate, John Glenn. And I looked around. There was the only seat at the table was the chair at the head of the table. And I've got my little tray in my hand, and I'm going, I don't think so. I'm not walking up to the head of that table. But there's no other chair at the table. And so I'm sitting there, and this is, I'm beginning to look stupid after what seemed like an hour, about 10 seconds. I finally said, well, I better just sit in that chair at the head of the table. None of them are talking. It's very quiet for some reason. I didn't understand when I'd been there for the first time. I go over to sit down in that chair, and the entire table goes, "You, where are you? Are you? You can't sit in that chair. What are you thinking of? Don't you know whose chair that is?" And of course, my knees are rattling, my hands are shaking. I said, "Well, whose chair is it?" They said, "That chair belongs to Chairman Jim Eastland." I said, "He died." They said, "We know, but he may come back." and they roared laughing. This was, they've been waiting all afternoon for me to walk in just to do that. Well, I know it sounds kind of boys' school stuff to you, but it was a reflection of how the place functioned. And that table, for the next 8 or 10 years, was like a PhD in politics. Because there was the ribbing that went on, the storytelling, but also there was that, you've got that idea, I've got this one, and ways of doing things. And I, like any other institution, if you could somehow magically bring some of that back, and I think you do so because you eliminate the highly subsidized return trips to people, we had to spend a little time with each other. I had one senator, who you'd know who I was talking about if I mentioned his name, on the day I left, came up to me on the floor of the Senate and said, "You're leaving, I'm coming. What's your big advice?" Kind of ribbing, kind of jabbing me a little bit. I said, "My big advice is the following. You're a freshman in the minority. No one's going to pay much attention to you in the first year or so. And if I were you, I'd pick out the 20 people on this side of the aisle you think are your most ideological opposites. Invite each one of them to breakfast, lunch, or dinner. You'll find three things. One, you'll like them a lot more than you ever imagined. Two, you're going to agree with them on even far more than you would imagine. And that may frighten you, but it'll be the case. And as a result of the first two, you'll do things together here. That makes this job enjoyable, and the country's counting on that kind of activity." Now, I don't know whether he did it or not, but to me, that is the critical component in many ways. Deciding, I remember when John Ashcroft was my co-sponsor on lifting the travel restrictions to Cuba. People said, "How did you ever get John Ashcroft to do that?" Well, I went up and I asked him. I made my brilliant argument on why I thought it made a lot of sense from a foreign policy perspective. He said, "Put me on the bill." I said, "Were you impressed by my brilliance of my argument?" He said, "No, I got a bunch of rice farmers in southern Missouri who'd like to sell their rice in Cuba. That's why I'm on the bill." You know? Well, again, I never would have found the answer had you not talked to them and had enough of a confidence and relationship with each other. We could have that conversation. It's labor intensive. With all the new technology, it still is member to member. And you've got to spend time with each other to get to know them.
We have, Tom, hold off for a second. We have been like the Senate up here. I want to, we're close to our time. In fact, we're about to pass. I'd like to bring in sort of several voices at once. This gentleman, those two folks over there. I'm sorry for the others. And Tom, you can, and we'll just go down the panel. I think we have to end in a reasonably timely way.
Thank you. I'm Professor Wayne Glass from the School of International Relations, the University of Southern California, former senior policy advisor to Senator Jeff Bingaman. Been close to the action here, gentlemen. Cloture rules are not etched in stone. They've changed over time. Senator Merkley recently introduced some reform efforts to change the filibuster rule that would require those who choose to filibuster to filibuster to make it more difficult for those who choose to do that. From outside the Beltway, Congress seems to be broken because we won't even debate the major issues of the day. Your statistics, I think, were instructive in that regard. What are chances of any filibuster reform, or is the culture such that there will be no reform and will continue to go in the same direction we've been going? Thank you.
But now, hold your thought? Yeah. I want to bring in several people at once. Just so we get them in. This young man at the front, right over here, if you don't mind being called a young man. Yeah. I would love to be called a young man.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is James Reed. I'm a student at George Washington University. Make this quick. There's a deficit of financial literacy in our country, so I was wondering how the bill addresses that, if there's any key players in Congress that have dealt with that, or if anyone during the bill's drafting have dealt with that.
Good question. Right, that gentleman on the aisle, and then I think there was one, and then that lady.
Thank you. Larry Checo, Checo Communications. I was just wondering, Senator Dodd, if there's any awareness on Capitol Hill as to how frustrated and angry the population is, or the voters are, while we're waiting for 535 men to go from adolescence to maturity. It's really, you know, while they're debating, there are millions and millions of people suffering out here. Thank you.
And this lady over here. There are, by the way, a lot more women now in that 535.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Saba Ahmed. I'm a law student at American University. My question was to you, Senator, if you can give some advice on new folks trying to lobby Congress. I am new in the career, but I'm very interested in learning and helping Congress understand the other side to Middle East and Muslim issues.
Good for you.
Thanks.
That's great. So here's what I'm going to do. We've got the filibuster again, financial literacy. Do members of Congress understand how frustrated people are? You might tell that great story of visiting Ted Kennedy's grave at the end of how you made your decision. It's my moment for the Academy Award-winning moment in the movie of the book. Do lessons in lobbying. Can I just go down the panel, and also you could all sort of take these questions in any direction you wanted. Let me start with Tom, who, and then go Tom, Senator, and Bob.
Just two comments on the filibuster. Prospects for change, not good right now. Reid still doesn't have the 51 votes he would need in cooperation with the chair of, sitting in the chair of the vice president, to, in effect, create a new precedent in the Senate that would allow some alterations in the way nominations are handled. So I think the pressure is coming from the bright, young, new Democrats who are really unhappy about how their institution is working. The one change that would be good, it's not making them filibuster, it's making the filibustering party produce 41 votes and not forcing the other party trying to do business to produce 60 votes on a recurring basis. That would make a huge difference, and there is a chance at that. Sort of one last comment. Bob and Chris both had wise things to say about money and non-competitive seats and redistricting and other things. And I'm a pro-reformer on these things. But my view is, for the foreseeable future, the best route of change, if I'm correct, that a majority of Americans do not support a dramatic constriction in the size and role of government in their lives. If I'm correct in that, then the route is with them being led by Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Mike Lee, the Republicans will decline. They will not regain the Senate. They will lose the next presidential election, and they will lose the House at some point. The majorities may be large enough for Democrats to govern, even in the Senate, under those circumstances. If that happens, some Republicans will feel obliged to do business with them, and you'll begin to try to set a new dynamic, which will allow new voices, more problem-solving, moderate conservative voices to emerge in the party to get us back. But it's either a dominant one-party democratic system to get some things done, or slowly or quickly a situation in which the Republican Party returns to its sanity and to a position of problem solving.
Jeff is a great member, and you served with a terrific human. Jeff Bingham, for those of you who just, that was a wonderful, wonderful United States Senator, a good friend. So I'm glad you're here today. And actually, some of the ideas that were posed, I think Lamar Alexander was working with Chuck Schumer and others and made some suggestions. For instance, on the motion to proceed, I think having a filibuster ridiculous, in my view. I mean, you want a filibuster to get to the substance of the bill and so forth. So there are various things that I think make some sense in reform areas that were suggested. I think the idea of actually having to get up there and talk. And the majority can make you do that as well, too. I mean, the idea that you let people off the hook by once someone says they're going to filibuster, then you all of a sudden shut the thing down, going to a quorum call, in my view, is you ought to make people then do it, in a sense. And at least then you can have a debate or having to listen to some argument people have to make on the case. So I think that some of those ideas made some sense. With regard to financial literacy, it's a great question. And Senator Dan Akaka of Hawaii, no longer with us, but he used to argue for this all the time. And we made the case on a number of times during the debate. I have very young children, despite I'm the only guy I know that get mail from AARP and diaper services. I have very young kids. But my two little girls, I don't see any reason why they couldn't be learning financial services in their math classes on how to balance a checkbook, all sorts of things that we ought to incorporate. I mean, it goes to the point, not just do members really understand all of this, but the general public understanding what goes on. So it's a very good point, and one that we've talked a lot about. It has been, I think, some resolutions on it, but nothing in a meaningful way that would require it along the process. Getting angry at constituencies, if you don't really have to face the opposition. It's the old knocking on the door and having the screen door bang in your nose. Not a bad thing to have happen, in my view. No one likes to have that happen. It's always uncomfortable, but I think it's healthy. But today, given the mechanics of politics, you can avoid actually meeting anybody who's angry. You can just see your own folks, if you want, in the process. And I think we all suffer as a result of that a little bit in the political debate and discussion. I do think people get it and understand it, particularly over the last few years, the level of anger. People have sensed it. We saw it certainly in August of 2009 with the town hall meetings that exploded, Occupy Wall Street as well. Most Americans don't fit into either one of those comfortable groups. They're not going to go out and scream at their congressman, and they're not going to put up a pup tent in Lafayette Square. But they are frustrated by things not working. And I think, again, I based on conversations, I've had a few of them, people seem to get it. And lastly, on your point here, and first of all, thank you for raising the issue. I'm sorry that the word lobbyist has become a pejorative. The First Amendment in our country insists that people petition government. And there are obviously lobbyists who are well paid and take advantage of that situation. But I think you're well served. If you have enough sense to listen to one, good lobbyists will give you good, accurate information. They'll have a point of view. But the ones that I always were willing to listen to and I found helpful, one of the things we did in the financial reform bill we didn't talk about much here is Eddie Silverman. In fact, Eddie's made this point to me, the former staff director. Every person that wanted to see the committee during that year and a half to bring up a point, we made sure they had a chance to get to our office to talk. I didn't meet with them all because it would have been endless if I had done it. But Ed did, and members of the staff did. Julie, you did on countless occasions, all across the spectrum on the derivatives discussion. Julie Chong would meet with anybody that wanted to talk about that. I felt very strongly that people ought to have the right to be heard on these matters, and not everyone gets to be a witness in a congressional hearing. And so I believe that lobbying is an important point, that people ought to be able to express themselves, raise important facts to you along the way. And so I'd urge you, one, keep your facts straight. Make sure you're accurate when you get in there. Don't take a long time to make your points. There's only so much time. And find ways to lobby back in a person's district or in their state. They're more apt to remember what you tell them back on the home turf than they are necessarily in their office here. So getting people in that congressman's district or that senator's state that are involved and care about the issues you do is apt to leave a more indelible impression with them than one when you're a long list of people they may see on a very busy day. But be accurate. Make sure your information is good. The one way I never let anyone back in my office again was if they weren't honest and didn't have information that I could count on as being accurate. That was the last time they got to see me. People who had good information, were factually correct, even though they had a point of view different than mine, I welcome back any time to come to the office. But I'm really upset that we don't understand or are losing our appreciation of the value of doing exactly what you've just described you'd like to do to talk about an issue you care deeply about.
Yeah. Thank you. Bob, closing remarks.
Well, I want to say something about, we talked about, somebody quoted my statement, Tom, I guess, about the transformation of the Republican Party being the biggest political event of my lifetime. The second biggest political event is the growth of the number of Americans who refuse to identify with either party. We have a real centrist, independent group now in the electorate that don't want to be called Republicans and don't want to be called Democrats. And I think Democrats particularly, and a number of our good commentators from the left, including EJ and Tom, are too soft on the Democratic Party and its corruption, and on the fact that a great many ordinary Americans don't see enough of a difference between the two parties in their attitudes about money and politics particularly, but a lot of other things too, not policy issues so much as procedural issues and the nature of politics. But I think this is a big price the Democrats are now paying, and that they have to face up to it.
Can I just say one? You know, I didn't. You know, I should have said this in the outset, and I apologize. I was blessed in this whole process of having a partner named Barney Frank. Barney had brought many great qualities to this. One thing he did and understand, and Gene did it in his office as well, and you don't get this all the time in the House, is understanding the Senate, which is not an easy thing to do. But Barney was an inseparable and an incredible partner. We never could have done this without him. And so I don't want this gathering to conclude without me at least giving the opportunity in a public setting for the first time to say to Gene and to his staff, to Dave and others, but particularly to Barney, that without his cooperation and support, we would never gotten all the way through this. So my hat's off to Barney. I'm sorry he's not here today to join in this discussion, but was a great ally in this process. And thank you, Gene. And to Amy, obviously, and Eddie as well, my staff were here. But, Gene, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention you and Barney, and I thank you.
Just two quick points. One is that Barney actually was invited, wanted to come, and couldn't come. And the second is I love Bob so much that I won't even reply to that last shot at Tom Mann and me, but we'll deal with it afterward. And I will still recommend that you buy the book. And I want to, that's loyalty or foolishness on my part. I do want to read one paragraph before you go out and buy the book. The paragraph reads, a final curiosity about Dodd-Frank. The big, substantial, and consequential new law never really penetrated the public consciousness. As we've seen, it wasn't even well understood by most of the members of the House and Senate who voted for or against it. All of its complex provisions were never carefully dissected in House or Senate hearings or by the popular news media. You don't have to be one of those people. You can go out and buy Bob's book right now. I want to thank our distinguished panel, Tom Mann, Chris Dodd, and Bob Kaiser, and thank you all for coming.